I want to thank all of you who are here, and particularly I want to thank Les Jamison and the New York 9/11 Truth Movement for creating this opportunity for me to be here with you. And particularly to Bernard White and Yasmin, who have been our splendid hosts and supporters over the years. I'm going to speak today about 9/11 and the repressive apparatus of the capitalist state. But since I'm coming before Ralph and after Tico-san, I'm going to continue some of the history that he so eloquently presented. Only we're fast-forwarding to the 20th century. In preparing my speech, I too, like Les, went back to some of the early work that Ralph and I did about 9/11, 7 years ago. And in particularly to Ralph's seminal presentation, a WBAI five-hour presentation, World Trade Center Uncensored History, and a year later, the work we did with 9/11 False Flag Operation. So I want to read to you the first couple of paragraphs from that 9/11 false flag operation, which was broadcast on WBAI on September 10th, 2002, because it gives you an overall context. At least it provided that for me, and I think it'll do so for you. In the immediate aftermath of the attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, authorities already were sounding the alarm that a terrorist network was involved, and they specified Osama bin Laden and Islamic fundamentalists in the Al-Qaeda network. The authorities did not disclose, however, that this very network had been established by the Central Intelligence Agency, and that Osama bin Laden and his associate, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, had received $6 billion from U.S. intelligence agencies, specifically to create a terrorist network, not merely in Afghanistan, but in Pakistan and beyond, in Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and the surrounding area. The authorities were quick to point the finger at a demonic figure, and I have to add that they are still doing so with the false Osama bin Laden tape that was released in Kansas City yesterday. But if we look carefully at the press at the time, that is, even in 2001, and in the time since, specifically in the year between 2001 and 2002, and still more beyond, we find that, in fact, the U.S. government, its intelligence agencies, and its spokespersons were not telling the truth. 9/11, we stated then, as we state again, is a false flag operation, an intelligence term that signifies that the blame has been placed elsewhere to conceal U.S. government authorship. At the time we were writing that, we were very specific with the reasons why we said that 9/11 was a false flag operation. And in the limited time I have here today, I won't discuss that specifically, but many people today will do so. But I would like to refer to an intelligence operative, one upon whom the United States relied for building specifically the terrorist network that was to bring down the Soviet Union and its support for the government of Afghanistan at the time, who was so instrumental for creating what Zbigniew Brzezinski, who had been President Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, had called the grand chessboard. That is, the designs, the imperial designs for control of the Caspian region, and even further, moving in to Asia and China. This person is General Gul Hamid, in charge of the ISI, that is, the Pakistani Intelligence Service, And in an interview with Arno de Borsgrave, he stated, quote, "All summer long, we've heard about America's shining surplus, that the Pentagon will not have sufficient funds to modernize for the 21st century. Presto," Gul Hamid said, "all of a sudden, the Pentagon can get what it wants without any opposition. How very convenient." What he's referring to had been disclosed, although wasn't very public, in a document that had been written in September 2000, Rebuilding America's Defenses, which was a reprise of other documents that had been written by Dick Cheney and his crew when he had been a defense secretary. But now he was on board to be vice president to George W. Bush. And the Project for a New American Century, a neocon group who has as its members a who's who of the ruling class of America. And they produced a document, Rebuilding America's Defenses. And in there, there was one sentence that was picked up much later. Because Rebuilding America's Defenses is a very large document that shows why America has to build, why the United States has to be the dominant military force in the world, and how the U.S. government could go about creating this incredible imperial army in the aftermath of the breakup of the Soviet Union. And it states specifically this one line, which is probably familiar to all of you, quote, "The process of transformation," referring to the military buildup, "is likely to be a long one, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing events like a new Pearl Harbor." Written September 2000, 1 year later, that new Pearl Harbor was created. Why did they want a dominant military force? It doesn't come out of the abstract. It is to put forward, to control, to have hegemony over the world's resources. And here in the United States, with the militarization of the police and the extension, as we saw later with the Northern Command, of the coincidence of the military, the Pentagon military, and the militarized police, to suppress the population here in the United States that they saw was going to have an uprising, would be opposed to their demands, not only their demands to suppress the population around the world that would again have uprisings against U.S. designs, but also the population here that was going to be starved by the shuttling of resources from healthcare, from education, from all the social benefits to building this hegemonic military. Long-standing plans, these were. These are not dreams that took place in the few months. These are not dreams that only belong to a Republican Party. These are plans that have gone from one administration, be it Democratic, to another administration, be it Republican. They may wear different hats, but their goals as representatives of the bourgeois rulers are the same. Again, in referring to Ralph's books, Iraq and Kuwait, History Suppressed, which discusses the plans to seize Arab oil, or in World Trade Center, Uncensored History, I was taken aback again at how succinct he had been in describing the designs on Central Asia. So today I want to refer to just a few pieces, because throughout the 1990s, as an economist, I was watching one paper after another talking about the significance of Central Asian oil, and specifically the significance of control of Afghanistan and the pipeline that UNICAL said was necessary to bring the oil efficiently from the Caspian Sea down to the Indian Ocean. And here we have long-standing plans. Michael Evans The London Times defense editor wrote, September 20th, 2001, "Secret Plans for a 10-Year War" was the title, and he discussed Operation Noble Eagle, the plans of the U.S. and Great Britain for what he termed was going to be specifically a 10-year war. The BBC, September 18th, 2001, quote, "The U.S. planned the attack on the Taliban and the military action against Osama bin Laden in July, long before the events of 9/11. And they continued, "Nayaz Nayak, former Pakistani foreign secretary, was told, he told the BBC, he had been specifically informed in mid-July that military operations would be launched in mid-October." And that's when they launched the military operations. But it goes further. These plans weren't launched in July. These are long-standing plans. And if we look at the 1970s, we can see the focus on Arab oil. Robert Tucker, 1975, "Seizing Arab Oil Fields by Direct Military Intervention" was the title of his article, 1975. And Tucker describes, quote, "the Arab shoreline of the Gulf, a new El Dorado awaiting its conquistador." Very similar to what we heard before me from Tico-san. The conquistadors, the modern conquistadors, the imperial might of the bourgeois states. This area extended from Kuwait down along the coast region of Qatar. 40% of OPEC production and 50% of OPEC reserves are in this area. And what Tucker says, there's no substantial population. We're not going to have the problems that we had in Vietnam. He's very specific. Soon afterwards, Harper's Magazine, again, 1975, Miles Ignotis, who it turned out is a CIA asset, Edward Luttwak, who we heard again from in 2001. "Seizing Arab Oil" was the title of this article in Harper's Magazine. They're blatant. And it was a blueprint. In 1975, this article was a blueprint for the 1991 Operation Desert Shield, which became Operation Desert Storm 16 years later. So let's fast forward from 1975 to the 1990s. By 2050, all the think tanks, these bourgeois oil think tanks, were saying, and particularly the Oil and Gas Journal, which is the particular magazine that the oil companies and the oil explorers read. Oil and Gas Journal in the 1990s was writing, "By 2050, Central Asia will account for more than 80% of U.S. oil. Central Asia represents the world's last great frontier for geological survey and analysis, offering opportunities for investment, production, transportation, and refining of trillions of dollars of oil and gas services." But they all noted, and particularly Oil and Gas Journal, "This requires unimpeded access to the stands, by which they mean Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, and they include Afghanistan and Pakistan, a country that we don't normally think of as having oil reserves." But the Oil and Gas Journal noted that in the remote desert parts of Pakistan, you have untapped oil reserves underneath those remote deserts. They're writing before 9/11. And what they say about Pakistan, a country that we don't normally think about when we think about the imperial reach, we think of Pakistan as an aid to the U.S. military, but we don't understand, we don't think yet about the fact that they have designs on the oil reserves of Pakistan. It says that these remote deserts in Pakistan are, quote, "held hostage by armed tribal groups. They demand a better arrangement." And as we see now, the U.S. is arranging that better arrangement by having Musharraf work with Benazir Bhutto. Congressional hearings in the 1990s took place. the House, H.R. 2867, they're so blatant, came out with a version that they called Silk Road Strategy Act. The Silk Road, they're going back to the days of Marco Polo. They're using the same language. And this was a specific congressional act in order to create a Eurasian Energy Transport Corridor, a pipeline that was going to go south from Central Asia to the Indian Ocean. And they noted in these congressional hearings there were $60 billion in short-term reserves, and they could get $200 billion as their real estimate. There was a consortium of 11 foreign oil companies that included Unocal, as I mentioned before, with the big designs for the pipeline in Afghanistan, Amoco, Exxon, and Pennzoil, who all had projects in the Caspian Sea. March 3, 1999, little less than 2 years before 9/11, a Senate subcommittee on international economic policy again had hearings where John Maresca from Unocal gave his incredible presentations about the importance of controlling Central Asia. The Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, again, a who's who of American rulers, their study, Central Asia on the periphery of a new global war. A new global war. They understood they weren't going to get access to these resources by just moving in and shelling out a few dollars to one dictator or another. Oops. Move forward to 2001. October 2001, Air Force General Richard Myers, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He's on ABC. And he's asked on ABC this week whether targets had been started to prepare in Iraq. He had said at the time, it's very clear Afghanistan is a small piece of the war. And so they were asking him, what's next if Afghanistan is just a small piece? And Richard Myers was very clear. He said, this is a global war on terrorism and weapons of mass destruction. Afghanistan is only one small piece. Of course, we're thinking very broadly. Since World War II, we haven't thought this broadly about a campaign. General Myers was then asked about a comment by Vice President Dick Cheney, who had said that the campaign, quote, may never end, at least in our lifetime. And Vice President Dick Cheney had made that comment to the Washington Post and was published Sunday, October 23rd, a month and a half after the events of 9/11. And General Myers said, I think this is correct. Quote, this is going to be a long, hard-fought conflict, and it will be global in scale, and it won't just be military. It's going to be all the instruments of our national power. All the instruments of our national power. What does he mean? And that leads me to the discussion of the repressive apparatus of the capitalist state, and why 9/11 was so significant to this dysfunctional and decaying capitalist state. Back to General Gul Hamid. It's amazing how articulate, how right on the money. They're not afraid to say what they mean and what they are doing. And Gul Hamid had said in the same interview with Arno de Borgsgrave, quote, even your cherished civil liberties will be abridged with impunity. To protect the expansion of the hegemony of transnational capitalism, they now have the excuse they want to crush anti-globalization protests. Now you will remember the protests against the World Organization, the economic forums. You will remember the protests against the anti-war protests that arise as a result of the invasion of Iraq. You understand the protests against the falsifications of 9/11. You understand the daily protests that take place day in, day out in inner cities across this country, the militarization over 2 million people in prison in this country, and many more on parole. These are protests, protests against a world that attacks each and every one of us. Vice President Dick Cheney, on September 16th, 5 days after 9/11, was explicit. He said, quote, "We have to work the dark side," he said to NBC's Tim Russert. Quote, "We've got to spend time in the shadows using sources and methods that are available to our intelligence agency. It's going to be vital to us to use any means at our disposal." And 2 days later, President Bush signed a secret presidential executive order authorizing the CIA to create a specific paramilitary teams to, quote, "hunt, capture, detain, or kill designated terrorists almost anywhere in the world." First targets Afghanistan, other targets Iraq, and other countries. This was a secret executive order. And what the interrogation program came out has now been exposed, was designed by psychologists nonetheless, and it was based on the Phoenix program methods used in Vietnam, which has been disclosed, never revealed much intelligence anyway, but was a torture program, a horrendous torture program, reaching 75,000 people. And they studied and they talked to the intelligence services in Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and of course the Israeli Mossad. They used outside contractors, they used CIA agents, they used all means possible. This is some of this, the tip of this has been exposed by Human Rights Watch, the Special Commission to the European Parliament, who studied particularly extraordinary rendition, that is, capturing people and taking them to secret CIA prisons. The Red Cross even was so outraged that there were leaks of some of its reports, and the Center for Constitutional Rights started a large-scale campaign with lawyers across the country in order to deal with the many people who were absconded and taken to Guantanamo. I have 5 minutes left. So what I want to point to you to is the ACLU. At the beginning of this year, every year they do a State of Civil Liberties in America. And on January 22nd, they did, again, a State of Civil Liberties. And these are some of the things that they noted about repression that has taken place since 9/11. And I added to that, and I will quickly go through it. And one, the Military Commissions Act of 2006 eliminated a cornerstone of our Constitution and made the president sole judge and jury. In other words, the Military Commissions Act, if you really study it and you study these executive orders, is setting up the basis for a dictatorship, for a martial law state. And we recently did four programs, we have another one to go, called Dictatorship and the Dysfunctional Capitalist State. So I suggest you go to our website and listen to the real details about this. What is essentially the Military Commissions Act, for the first time in the United States, eliminated habeas corpus. That is the right to challenge detention before a court. This is the basic element of due process of law. And what the Military Commissions Act did in, it was a response after Supreme Court actions, was to say that if you're not a citizen of the U.S., but you're still in the United States, you are not subject to due process of law. Also, it gave the president the sole power to determine who would be held indefinitely. Indefinite detention! Can you imagine that, to call yourself a democracy and have indefinite detention without being charged? Very similar to what the Israeli state, the Zionist state, does with Palestinians under the term administrative detention. You can be held indefinitely without being charged for a crime, and you can be subjected to what constitutes torture. Everyone agrees that the methods that are used are clearly torture. And this is now the law of the U.S. Well, I have to wrap up, unfortunately, so I can't go through my list. So I suggest that over the course, if I have an opportunity, I will go through the list. Much of what I would discuss about the repression has been on our programs over the last year, 2 years, 3 years, up 6 years. But I want to say, in wrapping up, that whatever repressive apparatus they think they can install, they can only do that if we are not on the streets, if we are not creating the organized opposition, if we don't build the political instruments, our own political party, that represents our interests. Because you have to remember, we are the many. They are the few. They cannot have a military without cannon fodder, without soldiers. These soldiers are our cousins, our brothers, our sisters, nieces, nephews, friends, neighbors. They cannot have an army. That army disintegrates when people will not fight. They cannot impose laws if people do not follow them. They cannot have a police force. Again, like the military, these are neighbors, friends. A police force cannot function, cannot oppress us if we do not allow it to. And again, when you have thousands and thousands and thousands of people in the streets, and you have people building coherent political organizations and not fighting against each other, but stepping in line with each other, building united fronts, they cannot achieve their goals. And this has been demonstrated time and again throughout history. Whatever we achieve, the social gains, we achieve through struggle. Whatever repressive apparatus seems to be imposed, and they are tightening the network of things that they started half a century ago, things they tried at the time of the Civil War, too, things they tried at the time of the American Revolution, because remember, the Bill of Rights was a second American Revolution. The Constitution was to respect the rights of property. The Bill of Rights was a second American Revolution of the people who demanded their liberties. And it is the same story today. We can achieve, and that is the purpose of this conference. The conference is to say to each and every one throughout the world, together we can do it. We can have a better life.